thumb on the little gold key that opens her gun cabinet. Then she looked up and realized I was watching her. Her eyes turned hard as obsidian. She stowed the keys in her purse and zipped it. "Is 2 hours going to be enough time?" I asked. I tried to keep my voice casual, disinterested. Irania responded the same way. "Sure, honey, fine." Jem gave up explaining the virtues of outer space marsupials to me. He climbed back onto a stool at the kitchen counter and started coloring a picture of Godzilla. "The Longoria case?" I asked. Irania hesitated long enough to confirm it. "It's nothing, honey. Don't worry about it. I'll just be able to run some checks faster while Jem's out with you." Jem colored a red halo around Godzilla's head, focusing his energy into the tip of his marker with a level of concentration no adult could match. "Irania," she cut me off with a look. When she spoke, she addressed the top of Jem's head. "Don't you waste time worrying about the wrong person, honey. I can tell you all about it next week when you're back at work." I didn't answer. Irania muttered something in Greek that sounded like a proverb. She sighed and put her purse on her forearm. "I'll meet you back here by 9, and no damn candy at the theater, huh?" Jem complained a little about that, telling her we always got dots and red vines, but he knew better than to push it. He just shut his mouth and let his mother rewrite the rules as ridiculously unfair as she wanted. That's a lesson everybody learns eventually with Irania. Chapter 23. After the movies, I dropped Jem off at Irania's house and flipped a coin. Compton or Blanc Eagle? I was half hoping the coin would land on its edge and I could go home. Instead, it came up Blanc Eagle. I headed out for the address I'd seen on Alex's driver's license, 1600 Mecca. Mecca Street, like its namesake, is a place most people only get to once in their lifetime, only with the help of Allah, and only after many tribulations. Once you do find the road, it twists illogically through the Hollywood Park subdivision, disappearing and then reappearing, following what was once a creek bed through the rolling hills, just inside Loop 1604. I took 281 north and gave myself up to the Hajj as soon as I exited, praying that someday I'd find Alex Blanc Eagle's house. Hollywood Park was showing its age since I'd been there last. Almost 10 years before. The pseudo-ranch houses that lined the streets were now more weathered. The lawns that had been grafted with fruit trees and turf grass now regressed in spots to the original scrub brush, mesquites, and cactus. On most blocks, the pristine look of affluent gringo land had given way to more down-to-earth realities. Plastic daisy pinwheels in the yards, porches overflowing with tricycles, windsocks, political signboards, pumpkins, and paper skeletons. Blanc Eagle's house was in one of the nicer areas, with half-acre lots and expensive cast-iron mailboxes and the occasional white split-rail fence. The house itself was a two-story affair, half limestone, half cedar siding, set far back from the road. I parked a block down on Mecca, then walked up the gravel driveway toward the front porch, my backpack in hand. No exterior lights. Dim illumination from behind an upstairs curtain, more from around the side of the house, kitchen window maybe. I was almost to the porch before I realized that the front door wasn't really painted black. It was just completely open. I stood to one side on the porch and let my eyes adjust. Then I moved inside and stood against the wall. A man's living room, lit only by the glow from the hallway on the right and from the staircase on the left. There were two large easy chairs and a mismatching love seat, all ugly and functional. A big screen TV and cabinet of stereo equipment, a bookshelf that was mostly filled with CDs, stacked sideways, a bar in the corner. A sliding glass door that led out to a back porch. There was also a strange combination of smells that I didn't like at all. Very old cigarette smoke, mildew, dead rat. I listened. Faint clinking sounds came from down the hallway, from the kitchen. I should have left right then. Instead, I walked down the hallway, into the kitchen, and into the line of fire of Sam Barrera, Senior Regional Director of iTech Security and Investigations. He was sitting behind the butcher block table eating a gallon-sized bowl of corn pops, and his little .22 was pointed exactly the spot my forehead appeared as I came into the room. There was no surprise on his face when he saw me. With his free hand, he put down the spoon and wiped a dribble of milk off his chin. He said, "Drop the backpack. Come in and turn around." "Hey, Sam, nice to see you too." I did what he told me very slowly. With a guy who'd been a special agent for the FBI for 16 years, you're better off not taking liberties. Sam came around the table and patted me down. He smelled, as usual, like Aramis. He took my wallet. I could hear him rummaging through the backpack, setting things out on the counter. Then, sitting back down behind the table, his corn pops hadn't even stopped crackling. "Look at me," he ordered. I turned. Sam was wearing a charcoal three-piece and a maroon tie. The gold rings made his right hand almost too chunky to hold the .22. He gave me his standard frown and hard, glassy eyes. He held up my roll of money from Milo Chavez and showed it to me. Then my studio photograph of Les St. Pierre. Then my business card from the Arena Manos agency. He waited for an explanation. "I'm a tidge bit curious myself," I told him. "Finding a high-profile corporate dick in somebody else's kitchen eating their corn pops with a spoon and a .22, I don't come across this scenario often." I was hungry. Mr. Blankeag wasn't going to need them. I looked at the ceiling. The smell of dead rat was fainter in the kitchen, but still present. When the realization finally hit me, it hit hard. I don't know why some things knock a hole in my gut and others don't. I've seen a dozen dead bodies. I've seen two people killed right in front of me. Usually it doesn't get me until much later, in the middle of the night, in the shower. This time, even with Blankeag in front of me, even considering I'd only met the guy once, something gave way like a trap door under my rib cage. The idea of that poor schmuck being upstairs dead, the guy who'd looked so drunk and pathetic and outclassed at Checkley's studio, who had done me the small favor of calling me a musician to get me out the door, the idea of him being reduced to a rodent smell got to me. Embarrassing, with Sam Barrera there. I had to swallow a couple of times, press my hands against the bumpy texture of the kitchen wall behind me. "Upstairs?" Barrera nodded. "2 days ago, I guessed, shot with a Beretta." Barrera started, a bit uneasy at my guesswork. "See," I said, "you passed up a hell of a trainee." "I'll live with it. Go look. I'll wait." It was almost easier than staying there in the kitchen. At least upstairs, if I threw up, I wouldn't have Barrera looking at me. My feet were heavy on the staircase. I breathed as shallowly as I could, but it didn't help. After only 2 days dead in a cool house, the smell shouldn't have been this cloying. Somehow, though, every time I smelled that smell, it seemed worse than the time before. Alex was face down on a queen-sized bed in the same clothes he'd worn at the Indian paintbrush. His left limbs were extended and his right limbs curled into his body, so it looked like he was rock climbing. The sheets were in a state of disarray that conformed to his posture, a clump of fabric gathered in his right hand. Fluids had crusted his face to the bedspread. There were flies. I stood at the doorway for a long time before I could make my feet cooperate. I forced myself to go closer, look for entrance wounds. There were two. A clean round hole in the back of the beige windbreaker, maybe shot from 10 feet away. The other, in Blankeag's temple, with the edges of the flesh starred and splitting. Very close range. Hard to be sure without stripping him, checking for lividity. But I was pretty sure the body hadn't been moved. He'd walked into his bedroom, somebody behind him. They'd shot him in the back. He fell forward onto the bed. They came up and finished it off. Simple. The rest of the room looked fuzzy, like all the light was bending toward the corpse. I tried to focus on the bedstand, the dresser, to look without touching. There was a shoebox on the bureau top, full of correspondence that looked carefully picked through. Drawers were open. A pair of rubber gloves was draped over the top one, and the chair was pushed out as if someone had just gotten up from it. Sam Barrera's work, half finished. Maybe it was possible that even Barrera got the creeps alone in a dark house, going through paperwork with a dead man right next to you on the bed. Maybe even Barrera had to take a corn pops break from that kind of work. I didn't throw up. I somehow made it all the way back down the stairs, back into the kitchen, where Barrera was still eating, one hand holding the .22 flat against the tabletop. "Can I sit down?" I asked. Barrera examined my face, maybe saw that I wasn't doing so hot. He waved at the stool opposite his. I sat, took a few breaths. "I take it you haven't called the police?" Sam lifted his right ear just slightly, like God was telling him something. "Blanc Eagle's been dead 2 days. He can wait another few hours. Now, I'm going to ask you what I asked Urania. What's your business with Blanc Eagle, with Les Saint-Pierre?" I stared at Barrera's cereal bowl, the little gold ball bearings in the white grease. My stomach did a somersault. Barrera said, "Try some. It'll help. Corn products are good." "No, thanks. Urania doesn't have any business with Blanc Eagle. I'm on my own." "On your own," he repeated. "That's right. Unlicensed." I nodded. Sam shook his head and looked sour, like his worst assumptions about human nature had just been confirmed. "Tell me everything," he ordered. And then we'll see." I told him the basics. Sam asked a few questions. What did Jean look like? What exactly had Les Saint-Pierre told Milo Chavez about his plan to force Tilden Sheckley's cooperation? Twice, Barrera dug out handfuls of dry corn pops from the box and ate them, one pop at a time. When I was done talking, he said, "I've already spoken with Detective Schaefer at SAPD. I'll talk to the Hollywood Park police. You were never here tonight. You are not working on this anymore." Just like that, "Tell Mr. Chavez he'll have to do the best he can for his artists. Tell him Les Saint-Pierre will probably show up on his own sooner or later, and there's no problem with Tilden Sheckley as far as you can determine. And that Santa Claus is getting him a nice tricycle for Christmas." Barrera frowned at me. He flexed his fingers, and the gold rings rubbed together with a sound like seashells. "This thing with the singer, Miranda Daniels," he said, "this is a sideline. Forget it." "You think it has anything to do with Saint-Pierre disappearing? You think a guy like Tilden Sheckley would waste his time with murders over a recording contract?" Barrera paused. "You don't know what you've stepped into, Navarre. I'm telling you to step back out." "There's some shipments going through the Indian paintbrush," I said. "Something from Germany. Big heavy cylinders. Blanc Eagle said the arrangement has been going on for about 6 years. Les Saint-Pierre found out about it from Julie Kearns, who probably got it from Alex Blanc Eagle. Les threatened to expose the business to keep Sheckley from pressing his claims on Miranda Daniels. Les miscalculated, either how bad the information was or how violently Sheck would react. Now, Les has disappeared, and the two people who helped him get his information are dead. How am I doing?" "Not well," Barrera said. "Shut up." "You spoke to Alex Blanc Eagle at least once before. He told me another investigator had been poking around. You were in Austin Saturday night arguing with Julie Kearns after I knocked off surveillance. At the time, she wouldn't cooperate. She shooed you out of the house with a gun. By Sunday night, after I'd rattled her too, maybe after she'd gotten some calls from Sheck's people, she was scared enough to set up a meeting with you in San Antonio. Somehow Sheck found out about it. Julie still didn't trust you, so she came armed, without any information written down. She got to your rendezvous a little early, or you got there a little late, and she got shot in the head. You got there, found a murder scene, and decided it was safest to drive on by and ask questions later. Who are you working for, Sam? What is Sheckley hiding that's worth killing people?" Barrera stood up slowly, checked his gold watch. Gather your stuff, go home and stay there. I'm going to call it in. You've got 5 full-time operatives just in the San Antonio office. 15 more, regionally. You've got a dozen national clients subcontracting investigations through you. If you're here in Blanc Eagle's living room yourself, taking trips up to Austin to argue with Julie Kearns in person, this has to be big. Something your friends on the bureau lined up for you, maybe? Your other option is that I turn you over to some of the agencies involved. Some of the agencies? People far out of your Ligue Navarre. They could make very sure you stay quiet. They would also have some hard questions for Irene Manos about the way that you're operating. We could be looking at a revoked license for her, a guarantee your application never comes up for review. That's all before we bring in the DA. You'd be such a bastard? Sam looked at me dispassionately. There was no implied threat. It was a simple multiple-choice test. All right. I started to gather up my money, my burglar's tools, my photos and paperwork. I stuffed it all into my backpack. My fingers didn't work very well. My stomach still felt fluttery, warm. Sam Barrera watched me zip my bag. I wouldn't say he relaxed, but his eyes got a little less intense. He put his gun in his belt behind his coat. He tilted his head sideways, stretching his neck muscles, and the little shiny black square of hair on top of his head glistened. "You said 6 years," he told me. "That's about right. Maybe someday I'll show you my file cabinets, show you how a real case is put together. Maybe I can explain to you what it's like, all that build-up and documentation, only to find an informant you've been courting disappeared, then another one shot in the head the day you wanted to interview him. Then, to have somebody like you waltz in and act like you own the situation. You're not doing Irene any favors following this line of work, kid. You're not doing yourself any favors. Go home." I picked up my bag, got unsteadily to my feet. "And Navarre," Sam said, "you didn't find anything. Nothing to indicate Les St. Pierre's whereabouts. No documentation you can't explain." It took me a second to realize he was actually asking me a question rather than giving me another order. I stared at him until he felt obliged to add, "St. Pierre was supposed to give me some information. It wasn't up there at Blanc Eagle's bedroom, and it wasn't in Julie Kearns' house." I shook my head. The only piece I hadn't told Barrera about was the personnel files, and those weren't blackmail material. At the moment, they seemed a petty thing to hide, a grudgingly small way to get some revenge on Barrera. "Nothing," I told him. "I found nothing. Just the way you thought, Sam." He scrutinized my face, then nodded. When I left, he was just starting to talk to the Hollywood Park police on the phone, explaining to them exactly how they were going to handle his problem. Chapter 24. Milo's green Jeep Cherokee honked in my driveway at 10 o'clock Friday morning. I opened the passenger side door and said, "I don't believe it. She's alive." Sassy, the basset hound, sat up on the seat and yawned. Her tongue rolled into a long baloney canoe. She did a little shuffle on her front paws and snorted. Maybe it was a friendly greeting. Maybe she was having a doggy coronary. "How old are you?" I demanded. "You make a deal with Satan?" Sassy panted. She turned her head to the left, trying to see me through her one eye that was milky with cataracts. Where the other eye should have been was a sagging canyon of gray, crusty fur.
"Sassy's plugging along okay," Milo admitted. "Got an abscess I have to drain every week."
He showed me one of Sassy's silky brown ears that normally would have made a perfect size 10.5 shoe liner. Today it looked like someone had sewn a squeeze bulb into it. Sassy kept grinning and panting as Milo examined the abscess. She turned her head side to side like somebody was calling her, but she couldn't figure out from where. I thought of Sassy as old when we dog-napped her from her abusive former owners in Berkeley 8 years ago. By now, Sassy must have been pushing 20. In canine years, she'd been around since the Civil War. It wasn't easy moving her into the back seat. Imagine a sack of bowling balls with stubby feet and bad breath. When we finally got underway, Milo broke out the extra-soft dog biscuits for her and beer for us. He poured the beer into coffee cups. We exited Loop 410 on Broadway and headed south, listening to Sassy chew. Most of the biscuit fell out the side of her mouth, but she went at it with gusto anyway. I handed Milo a single typewritten sheet of paper. He glanced at it as much as he could without losing his beer or running off the road.
"This is
my first report," he frowned.
"Your report? Am I paying extra for this?"
Irene Yamanos is trying to instill me with some nasty habits, following procedures, writing daily reports to clients, stuff like that. He handed it back to me.
"Give me an audio version."
I told him about Alex Blanc-Eagle's murder. Then I told him what Samuel Barrera had said about the party line I was supposed to give Milo to blow the case off. Sassy was apparently interested. She kept sticking her nose between the seats, trying to slobber her biscuit residue into my beer. When I finished, Milo said,
"And you still think Les disappeared on his own?"
"I think it's a strong possibility. I think he was using Julie Kearns in more than one way. He got her to steal some personnel files from her temp jobs, probably sold her on the idea they'd be running off together, even brought over a suitcase as a show of good faith. Then he ditched her."
"And she didn't say anything to anyone? Why?"
"She couldn't go bragging about what she'd been doing, helping Les blackmail Sheckley. Maybe she was hoping Les would still come back for her. Maybe she just didn't want to admit she'd been had."
"But you're not certain of any of that."
"That's why I want to look around Les's house."
"You've seen what Sheckley is like, Navarre. Now Alex Blanc-Eagle is dead. It doesn't take a genius to figure out what happened to Les."
We drove a few blocks in silence. Milo could have been right. It would have been a lot easier on Milo to think his boss hadn't voluntarily left him waist-deep in trouble. It would be a lot easier on me to believe Les St. Pierre was just another corpse waiting to be found. Corpses are stationary targets. Otherwise, if Les St. Pierre had adopted a new identity with Julie Kearns' help, then even with Kelly Arguello and me working overtime to find him, the chances of tracking him down were slim. The chances of tracking him down by next Friday, when Miranda's demo was due to Century Records, were virtually non-existent. If Sheckley insisted on his bogus first option contract, there'd be no effective way of challenging him. Miranda would go back to Sheckley's stable. She'd become another has-been artist waiting to happen.
"You're not following this Barrera guy's advice," Milo noticed, "about getting off the case."
"No, I'm not."
"Even though it could get you in trouble and your boss. Why?"
I didn't have an immediate answer. I threw another biscuit into the back seat, hoping Sassy's nose would follow it. No such luck. I turned my coffee mug in little half circles against my thigh and watched the businesses on Broadway go by. The abandoned Whopper Burger, the Witt Museum, the costume shop. Maybe I don't appreciate how Barrera called Miranda's problem a sideline. Maybe I don't appreciate how certain people are getting run over and Barrera treats them like they're small fish in a big pond. Some corporate client is paying him 5 or 6 figures to get them some justice. That much I'm sure of. I keep thinking about Julie Kearns and Alex Blanc-Eagle, and how many more people are going to get killed before Barrera considers it worth his client's financial while to do something. Milo nodded.
"I can't do 5 or 6 figures.
Beer in a coffee mug counts for a lot. Milo took a right onto Hildebrand. He used huge arm movements to turn the wheel like he was steering a boat. He had to hunch over to see out the windows that were made for normal-sized drivers.
"He's wrong, you know."
"Who?"
"Barrera. He's wrong about you not being cut out for this kind of work."
I stared at him. Finding occasional corpses, spending most of my time tracking paperwork in county courthouses and getting doors slammed in my face. You think this work you got me into is fun, Milo? Past 7 years, it's been like what people say about war. Hours of boredom punctuated by seconds of terror. Take it as a daily routine, it starts to grate on you. Milo smiled ruefully. He shook his head.
You're kidding yourself, man. What's that martial arts style you do? Tai Chi, right?
So?
The slowest style there is. The one that would drive most people crazy with impatience. What'd you study at UC? The Middle Ages?
So?
So it figures. Your medieval, all fucking over, Trace. Kind of a guy who'd work 17 years on one illuminated manuscript, or spend 12 hours getting into a suit of armor for a 3-second joust. That's you, Navar. Process wasn't hard. You wouldn't enjoy it.
I think I've just been called stupid. The corner of Milo's mouth crept up. He drove us over McAllister Highway, past Trinity University and into Monta Vista. We turned left on Main. Your father still live over here? I asked. Milo nodded.
Got nominated for Ray Feo at Fiesta last year. He was all excited.
I tried to remember what kind of businesses Milo's father owned. Auto supply stores, maybe. I tapped the small icon of the Virgen de Guadalupe that Milo had glued on his dashboard. Your folks finally got you back into the church?
Huh. Not exactly. The Virgin's for business.
Pardon? Milo shook his head sadly.
I didn't tell you why Les hired me.
Because you did his legal work?
No. That was a nice fringe benefit, but no. Les wanted to get into the Tejano market. I finally got Les to drop the idea and give me Miranda Daniels. But for a while there, I was driving all around town trying to sign wannabe Salinas.
I frowned. What did you know about Tejano music? Milo pinched the skin of his forearm. End of explanation. Your prospective clients liked the Virgin? Milo shrugged, looking at the Lady of Guadalupe, like she was a purchase he still wasn't completely satisfied with.
Some of them. Put them at ease, frame of reference. It was bad enough to speak to them in English.
I nodded. I'd spoken with Milo in Spanish only enough to know that he wasn't as comfortable with it as I was. There were plenty of Latinos who would consider Milo's lack of fluency a personal insult, a cultural lobotomy. I could almost see Ralph Arguello grinning. Can't be the only reason Les hired you, I said. Milo made a sour face.
No, not the only reason. Les also needed someone because he'd just forced his previous assistant to quit. They weren't seeing eye to eye on business decisions.
Who was his previous assistant?
Allison St. Pierre.
For no reason I could see, Sassy barked once, growled a little, then went back to her biscuits. Maybe Milo had her trained.
Speaking of the happy couple, Milo said.
We pulled in front of the St. Pierre's white stucco mansion. There were no cars in the driveway, but Brent Daniels' brown and white pickup with the horse trailer was parked on the curb. Milo scowled at the truck.
Why the hell did he do that?
What?
Brent dropped the equipment here. That was stupid.
Maybe. Milo was already shaking his head.
Shouldn't be anyone here this time of day except maybe the cleaning staff. Come on.
But Milo was already out of the car. Sassy needed help getting to the ground, but after that she waddled behind him at a pretty good clip. Milo had a key to the front door. Assuming nobody was home, he unlocked the dead bolt and let us in. That was a mistake. The front door led directly into a living room the size of a small church sanctuary. The walls were whitewashed stucco, striped with alternating columns of window and Oaxacan wall hangings that each must have represented the year's work of an entire village. There was a brick fireplace against one wall and a full bar against the other. The three white sofas around the fireplace would have taken up most of any other living room, but here they seemed ridiculously small, huddled together in the corner of a Satio-tiled wasteland. Plopped with apparent randomness around the rest of the room were pedestals displaying artwork. Some folk art, some bronze sculpture, some ceramic vases. All valuable, but totally unrelated to each other. There were two people together on the edge of the nearest white sofa, but before I could really process what I was seeing, Brent Daniels had jumped sideways and was straightening his checkered shirt and his jeans. That left only Alison St. Pierre on the edge of the sofa, leisurely tightening the belt on her white terry cloth robe. Her blonde hair was disheveled, her face a beautiful shade of red, like she'd just taken an invigorating swim in ice water.
"Sweetie," she said to me, "don't you knock?"
Chapter 25. Alison took a cigarette from a teak box on the coffee table. She lit it with a ceramic Roadrunner that had the business end of a lighter sticking out of its mouth, then held the cigarette with all five fingers like a cigar. We were sitting around the fireplace on the big white sofas. Milo crossed his arms and glared at Alison. I looked at the flecks in the iced tea the maid had just poured me. Sassy dozed contentedly with her head hanging off the sofa and her rump in Milo's lap, her tail thwacking against his belly. Brent Daniels was frowning at his own zipper, which he'd probably just realized was still half down.
"This is fun," Alison decided.
If she was at all uncomfortable being half disrobed in front of three men and a basset hound, she did a good job hiding it. She hooked her left foot behind her right knee, then made a feeble attempt to nudge the terry cloth back over her thigh with the bottom of her iced tea glass. It was quite a nice thigh. Next to her on the couch was a folded-over section of newspaper. I could see half a headline. "Daniels Set," and half a photo of Miranda. Alison caught me looking at it.
"You read this yet?"
she asked. When I shook my head, she glanced at Milo, silently asking him the same question. It was the first time she'd acknowledged Chavez's presence.
"I've seen it,"
Milo muttered. I looked at Milo for elaboration. He didn't look back. Alison grinned at me.
"Pressure's on, sweetie. This morning's recording Industry Times. They did a nice write-up on Miranda. Found out her demo is going to Century Records next week. Apparently, one of their in-house reviewers caught a show of hers last week. Said if the tape was half as good as the concert, Miranda Daniels was going to be Century Records' next chartbuster. That's kind of article creates a nice buzz going into a contract negotiation. Chalk up another one for Les St. Pierre."
Her eyes glittered with amusement. Milo's did not. Brent shifted uncomfortably, eyes still fixed on his zipper. Alison continued, unfazed.
"We were smart. We'd use this to sweeten the deal, get Brent better than 50% on the song royalties, go for a multi-record contract. Screw Les anyway, we could do better."
"We?"
Milo scratched the base of Sassy's tail.
"You going to start managing again, Alison?"
She kept smiling. She lifted her pinky as the cigarette burned down, but there was nothing dainty about the way she did it.
"That depends."
Milo sipped his tea.
"Geez, I don't know. You think the agency could afford it? You willing to start collecting commission payments outside the bedroom?"
Allison's expression hardened instantly. She shook her head, like she just asked herself a silent question and had decided the answer was no.
"You're a complete asshole, Chavez."
Milo nodded his thanks.
"Brand."
Alison stretched out his name, making her voice sweet again, like she was about to ask for a really huge favor. Brother Daniels looked at her. She waved her cigarette toward the front door. She smiled nicely. Brent frowned. He reluctantly undraped his arms from the top of the couch, stood, then zipped his pants. He looked at me like he wanted to say something.
"Bye-bye, sweetie,"
Allison said, dismissing him. Thanks again. Brent closed his mouth, lost a very brief stare down with Allison, and left. Allison looked me in the eye, daring me to speak. I didn't.
I've been staying in Austin with friends, she explained. Miranda's party being tonight and all. I thought I'd come back to town. Brent was nice enough to drive me down.
Uh-huh,
Milo said. Allison set down her glass very slowly.
You want to say something about that, Chavez?
Don't act so sensitive, honey. Not like Les would be surprised. Not like it's the first time you've tried to sleep your way in good with a major client.
Allison stood and dropped her cigarette. She took two normal steps toward Milo, then two very quick ones, making fists right before she came down on top of him. Sassy extruded out the middle like a sausage coming out of the grinder. Milo's tea glass toppled off the sofa and shattered on the tiles. By the time I realized just how ferociously Allison was hitting, it was too late for me to do anything. With difficulty, Milo managed to grab both of Allison's wrists and launch her sideways off her feet and onto the floor, but in that short amount of time, she'd done her share of damage. Milo had a red, fist-shaped welt burning under his right eye and another on his temple. Allison's fingernails had ripped two dotted lines of blood and skin across his neck. Milo's baby blue button-down was wrinkled and splattered with tea. A little stiffly, Allison sat up on the floor. She just missed landing on any broken glass. Her robe had come open, and the space between her breasts was tan and lightly freckled. She pushed her hair out of her eyes. She was a little out of breath, but her tone was surprisingly calm.
Soon as I get the agency, it's gonna be such a pleasure firing you.
Milo dabbed a finger on his neck.
Sure. In the meantime, we got problems. Trace wants to look around upstairs.
Allison took two deep breaths. She stood up. When she readjusted her robe, her fingernails left little bloodstains on the terry cloth. The maid materialized with a hand broom and dustpan. She walked over and began casually cleaning the broken glass, like this was an event that happened every day about this time. Allison brushed off her palms and looked at me. Her green eyes still had all the friendliness of a crocodile's.
Sure, sweetie, excuse me. I'm going to get a gun so I can kill Milo if he's still in my house when I get back.
There was nothing in her tone that even remotely hinted at a joke. After she left the room, Milo sat forward and rested his chin in one hand. Sassy came up to him and started licking a gash Allison had made on his forearm. "What is it with you two?" I demanded. Milo looked at me sadly, then decided not to try an explanation.
"Go on, bud," he said, waving toward a staircase. "Take your time."
"And if she comes back with a gun?" Milo stared at the doorway Allison had gone through.
Her aim is off. She tends to pull to the left. Don't worry unless you hear more than one shot.
As I headed toward the staircase, the maid was sweeping up the ice cubes and glass shards, offering Milo some Spanish words of consolation that I was pretty sure he couldn't understand. Chapter 26. Allison could have been standing in the doorway of Les's room for a long time, I'm not sure. I was sitting at Les's desk with my back to the door, sorting through shoeboxes full of old letters and photographs, and getting dizzy from trying to understand Mr. St. Pierre. The task should have been simple. I had the man's whole life in front of me, neatly packaged and labeled in little boxes. Still, I felt like a drunk taking a DUI test. I kept trying to put the old finger on the nose in the center of my face, and I'll be damned if the nose didn't move every time. Allison watched me at least long enough to identify which shoebox I was pulling letters from.
"That's his gotcha box," she said.
I'd like to think I didn't visibly jump, but Allison was grinning when I turned around. She'd changed into a peach polo shirt and black Mylar bike pants and white Adidas. She wore fingerless net gloves. If you didn't know to look, you wouldn't have noticed the stiffness in her left side where Milo had thrown her to the floor. I pulled another letter from the box that Les had labeled Correspondence.
"He's shown you these?" I asked.
Allison widened her eyes.
"Oh, no, he didn't show me."
She came in and sat on the very edge of the bed. From 10 feet away, I caught the scent of Halston. Her legs made a V in front of her, only the heels of her Adidas touching the carpet. She looked around with mild interest, like this was the first time she'd been in Les's bedroom.
"I'm sorry about downstairs."
She sounded like she was apologizing for a random nudge in an elevator.
"Milo gets to me."
I stared at her. She tried to mimic my expression, eyes wide, mouth slightly open.
"Problem?"
"No, I suppose not."
"Look, sweetie, you grow up with 4 brothers in a little hick town, you learn how to fight. If I sat around acting pretty and taking shit from guys like Chavez, I wouldn't have lived past 6th grade.
I decided it was safest to return my attention to the letter I'd been reading. It was poorly typed on onion-skin paper. All the O's were solid black circles, and the A's were cocked to the right. It read, "Dear Jason, I really appreciate what you said you would do for me, and I hope you like the songs and your publishing company will decide to take them for your catalog. I am really willing to work hard as a staff writer and really had a wonderful time with you this weekend, too. Please call soon. Patty Glenn." The letter was dated 5 years ago. Patty had stapled her picture to the back of it just in case Jason forgot who she was. She was cute, roundish face, feathery brown hair, widely spaced eyes, lit up with hope. There were at least 20 letters like that, dated as far back as 1982. Many with photos attached, all from different women, addressed to a different man's name. Sometimes they were to Larry, the label head, and sometimes to Paul, the producer. Sometimes, along with veiled references to nights of passion, they mentioned checks they were sending. One woman wrote that she'd enclosed $500 because she believed Jason Paul Larry was going to buy just the right birthday present that would put her name in solid with the artist and repertoire director at EMI Capital. I looked up at Allison.
"These letters." "Sure," she said. "They're all to Les."
Les had a reputation. He had real connections. If he wanted to use women, he didn't have to lie about who he was. Why? Allison paddled the toes of her shoes back and forth a few times.
"I never confronted him about it, but I think I know what he'd say. He'd tell you it was harmless fun. He'd say he was weeding the crop of would-bees, and if they were really this stupid, they would fall for the first con man they met in Nashville anyway, so he might as well save them the trip."
I couldn't quite grab on to Allison's tone. It wasn't resentment, more like wistfulness.
"You think it was harmless fun?"
Allison smiled, picking at the netting on her palm.
"No, sweetie. I think Les had an addiction. He was hooked on making himself the answer to everybody's problem. At least until you left the room or signed his contract or whatever. The less you mattered to him, the crazier he could afford to get, offering you what you wanted to hear, and the more he liked it. Do you see?"
"I'm not sure." She shrugged.
"I guess you'd have to meet him. It doesn't matter. The point is, he couldn't have stopped selling confidence if he wanted to. He was a hell of an agent."
"So why would he want to vanish?" Allison crossed her legs at the ankles and hunched forward, tapping her finger on her chin like she was pretending to think.
"Gosh, Trace, aside from the fact that he could never get out of his job any other way, that he was a natural-born son of a bitch, that his client list was eroding so bad he had to pin his hopes on unknowns like Miranda,
that he was drinking or snorting or popping most of his profits, that he and I fought every time we saw each other. I just can't imagine.
I stared at my lap, where I'd been collecting the most useful things from Les's desk drawers. I held up a black leather shaving kit full of pill bottles and bags. I pulled out one Ziploc with a dozen white tablets in it. "Amphetamines?" I asked. Allison shrugged. "I can't keep track. He drinks Ryman whiskey straight. The pills change. I think that's Ritalin."
"The stuff they give hyperactive kids?"
She smiled.
"That's my husband."
I dug through the other things. A 69 Denton High School yearbook, then some more photographs of Les with various music industry types.
"There's no will," I said.
"He won't make one. He was clear on that. He enjoys the idea of people fighting over his stuff when he's gone."
I shuffled through some other papers without really looking at them. I kept coming back to the photo of Patty Glenn.
"You said Miranda needed protecting from your husband. Is this what you meant?"
The idea seemed to amuse her.
"I said she needed to kick butt for herself, sweetie. That's different than being protected, and God, no. Les wouldn't have messed with Miranda, not like that, anyway."
"Because she has real talent?"
"Partly. Partly because of the way Miranda is.
Country girl, naive, a little too sweet for her own good. Seems like just the kind Les liked to prey on, not too different from the girls in this box."
Allison smiled, disappointed.
"I could say a lot of things, sweetie, but Miranda's my friend. You make your own conclusions."
I tried to read into that, but all I saw on her face was stubbornness, and maybe just the faintest tinge of resentment. I looked down at the correspondence box. These other women, didn't they eventually figure out who Les was? Didn't they get angry, cause problems?
Allison frowned like she was trying to remember some trivial detail from her prom night.
"They got taken by Les for a few nights, maybe a few $100. They felt good that their careers might be going somewhere. Then most of them faded back into the woodwork in Plano or Dime Box or wherever the hell they came from."
"You were one of them."
She flashed me exactly the same look she'd given Milo before she'd attacked him. It took her about 30 seconds to mentally stand down.
"No," she said. "You know the difference, sweetie? I got my revenge. I married the bastard."
Not much of a last laugh.
Allison spread her fingers apart so she could examine the netting between them.
"Good enough."
"If you're right, if Les vanished on his own, I bet he left you nothing in the bank and all the payments on the house and the credit cards and no guarantee of any income from the agency, at least not without a court fight. You can't even collect life insurance until you get him declared legally dead, and that could take
years. Allison's anger melted into a little smile, like I just made a pass she had no intention of accepting, but she appreciated the offer. She stood to leave.
"That's why I'm so glad you're here, Trace. You're going to bring old Les home to me."
She left me alone, staring at the picture of Patty Glenn, but wondering this time if there was something besides innocence there, some latent potential for maliciousness that needed to be stomped on. For a disturbing moment, I thought I might be understanding Les St. Pierre. I put the lid on the shoebox and decided it was time to leave.
Chapter 27.
Cam Compton's Monster Music was a two-story white cube on Perrin Bidle Road, right next to the Department of Public Safety. The bottom floor was the store, with burglar-barred windows and a five-car parking lot, and silver doors plastered with brand-name guitar stickers. The top floor was Cam's residence. His front door was on the side of the building, accessed by a metal staircase and a narrow concrete walkway.
There was one large picture window so Cam could look out every day and enjoy the scenery, an endless stream of gawky adolescents and bulldog-faced patrolmen engaged in the American ritual of parallel parking between the orange cones. I tried upstairs first and got no answer. Then I tried the music store, which for a Friday afternoon was not exactly crawling with customers. The guy behind the sales counter said, "Cam can't talk." I looked over the guy's shoulder, through the glass wall, into the room where Cam was giving a guitar lesson, to an adolescent kid whose acne was the same shade of red as his Stratocaster. Cam was hunched over, examining the kid's fingers as the kid moved them on the fretboard. Cam's forehead had a pancake-sized yellow and purple hickey on it from our last meeting at the Cactus Cafe. He had a heavy drinker's swollen morning-after face and rumpled clothes that suggested he'd crawled out of bed and down the steps just in time for this lesson. Probably a normal week in the life of a superstar guitarist. I looked back at the salesman. He was a large man, flabby large, with arms that had mass but no muscle lines. His face hadn't seen a razor blade or a toothbrush or even a nose hair clipper in a mighty long time. He had a Harley Davidson t-shirt with cigarette burn holes on the belly. "Cam's looked better," I said. Harley grinned. "Some guy's been leaning on him. Some big-ass motherfucker. Private detective or something. He slammed Cam's head into a wall. Then last night he came back and did Cam's ribs." "You saw this?" Harley leaned closer to me. "No. But you know what I told Cam. I said, take me along next time. I'll put that dick motherfucker in a vice grip." I smiled appreciatively. The slow, distorted power chords of Bad Religion seeped through the glass window of the practice room. Cam nodded his head, and the adolescent smiled. Talent under development. "He'll want to talk to me," I told Harley. "Tell him it's the dick motherfucker." Harley started to laugh. Then he saw I was serious. He scratched his beard. He pointed at me with his thumb and tried to frame a question. "I don't know about the ribs," I amended. "I just did the forehead, and it was a beer keg. You get prettier bruises with a beer keg." Harley scratched his beard with his fingers a little more. Then slowly, he cracked a grin. He turned and started what he'd been doing before I came in, hanging guitar straps on a rotating display. "Cam ain't much of a boss," Harley told me. "Be my guest." I walked into the practice room. Cam was nodding his head and saying encouraging things about the adolescent's F chord. Then they both saw me. I winked at the kid and told him to keep up the good work with the F chord. Then I looked at Cam, whose purplish forehead was turning almost flesh color. "How you feeling?"
"Got a student," he managed to say.
"He can practice." I turned to the kid.
"I bet you know glycerin already, don't you, Slick?"
The kid got that elated light in his eyes that beginning guitarists get when they actually know a request. He looked down and dutifully began plinking out the Bush song. "Let's talk," I told Cam.
"Why, you'd think I'd want to.
I went to see Alex Blancheagle last night. He looks a lot worse than you do. Jean paid him a visit." Cam's beady, bloodshot eyes move an inch farther apart. He looked around uncomfortably, at his student, at Harley, who was grinning sideways at us through the glass, waiting for some kind of show to start. Cam put his guitar pick between his lips and spoke around it.
"Upstairs. You ain't gonna fuck with me again, you hear?"
I held up my hands. Truce. Harley looked disappointed when he saw we were taking our conversation elsewhere. Cam led me out into the afternoon heat, then up the stairs and into his place. He headed straight for the refrigerator. His apartment was about the same size as mine. One main room, closet, bathroom, side kitchen. An unmade twin bed set flush against the south wall was occupied by piles of laundry that still retained the upside-down shape and crisscrossed texture of laundry baskets, like jello out of the molds. I counted three guitars in the room, two electrics in open cases on the floor, one black Ovation 12-string on a corner tripod stand. The coffee table was a Sears appliance box covered with spare guitar tuning pegs and string packets and old Olympia cans and an extra-large funky bird, the kind with the red hair and the hat and the big butt that bobs up and down. Instead of chairs, Cam had guitar amps. The posters on the walls were all from the store downstairs, peeling advertisements of bikini girls showing off the latest thing in mixing boards or speakers or trap sets. The only thing in the room that reflected care and meticulous upkeep was the CD collection. That took up three levels of cinder block and board shelving. I walked over and looked through the titles while Cam was rummaging for beer. The CDs were all kinds, rock and jazz and country guitarists, heavy on the Eric Clapton and the Chet Atkins, and too light on the Blind Willie McTell from iTaste. The titles were perfectly arranged in alphabetical order, except that the top shelf started with Cam's own releases. I was surprised how many. At least 15 different CDs. I pulled one. The cover art was a bad photocopy of Cam's face, with his name and the title American Cowboy, and the rest of the liner notes in what looked like Cyrillic script. Russian, Czech. I checked the other titles. Most were similar foreign releases. Only one was labeled Split Rail Records, dated 5 years ago, and entitled The Best of Cam Compton. Probably went platinum, that one. Cam opened himself an Olympia and walked over to the bed like he was in pain. He knocked the laundry off and sat down slowly, elbows out, the way you'd lower yourself into an extra hot bathtub. Your ribs are taped, I said. Somebody gave you a talking to last night. What the fuck business is that to you? I took the stack of Compton's own CDs and went over to an amp and sat down, facing him. I started flipping through the jewel cases. Interesting discography. Bulgaria, Romania, Germany. You must have had some success over there. Cam studied me warily. His one eye, with the bloody ring around the iris, was almost closed. His urge to play silent was duking it out with his urge to talk about himself. The latter finally won.
Good market in Europe, he admitted, especially since the eastern parts opened. Had me a number 10 song for a week in Yugoslavia before the country broke up.
That's so. He nodded morosely, like the whole political mess had been a plot to get him off the charts.
Course, Germany's always loved Texas stuff, horses, cowboy hats, country music.